The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening. This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday. I'm Nicole Sandler with you at NicoleSandler.com and, of course, on the Progressive Voices Network. And, you know, I start the show each day with that wonderful open produced by our friend Boca Brittany Summers. Not because I'm a journalist, because I'm not. I'm Nicole Sandler, and I'm not a journalist. I'm an opinion commentator. I deal with the news every day. I try to follow it and interpret it, and especially in this weird, overly complicated 24-hour news cycle that we live in, try to make some sense out of the usually nonsensical. But today it means even more, because our guest a little later on in the hour is Will Bunch, a columnist at the Philadelphia Daily News, the Philadelphia Inquirer. He writes the Attitude blog. He's written a couple of books, all around smart and really great guy, whose column a couple of days ago centered on an anniversary that happened yesterday, actually last night. Last night was the 50th anniversary of the night that Walter Cronkite went on TV and declared the truth about the war in Vietnam. Now, I was only 8 years old, so I don't really remember. But the little bit that I know of history tells me that that was a big turning point. Boy, things were so different then, because we had basically three channels. You know, there were three network newscasts, and Walter Cronkite was America's uncle. You know, he was the most trusted newsman in America. And news was objective back then. It was the news. And he stepped out and did something pretty courageous, which was he went over to Vietnam because he believed we were being lied to. We were. And he went on television and told the truth. Now, there's a big difference between the times. You know, today we have the internet. We have unlimited amounts of people with opinions like mine all over not only the airwaves, but all over the interwebs. And not only speaking the way I do with some air of authority because I'm behind a microphone and I've got this show that I've been doing for over a decade, which blows my mind. You know, people who just go on Facebook or Twitter and have an opinion, those opinions resonate with retweets and shares and follows. And one voice like Walter Cronkite's cannot cut through as easily as they used to. So a lot of questions for Will Bunch along those lines. And Will Bunch is a journalist. He's a columnist, but he's also a journalist. So I look forward to talking with him. I'll tell you what we'll do, because there's been more news since I record. I record What's News, the feature that airs throughout the day here on the Progressive Voices Network. Early in the morning, I get up early. I do What's News, like, you know, so I start on it somewhere around 7 a.m. And usually by the time I hit the air at 3, the show is live at 3. It's on Progressive Voices at 6. Some things have changed. So on days like today, I prefer to do it live, as the man said. So we'll just do it live.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
What's that you say? A good guy with a gun armed the teachers? Yeah, not so fast. Police in Georgia responded to shots fired at Dalton High School today and have taken a teacher into custody. Police in Georgia say a teacher apparently fired a gun inside a classroom and barricaded himself there for about 30 minutes before he was finally taken into custody. Thankfully, no children were hurt, but the school was evacuated. Parents are told to pick up their children at a nearby convention center, not to go to the school. Arm the teachers. What a great idea. Meanwhile, in Tallahassee, Florida, lawmakers are determined to do something when it comes to guns, just not what the students have been demanding, which is an assault weapons ban.
From student protesters today outside the state capitol there to Washington, where President Trump met with governors from all over the country, the call to take action is getting results. My sources tonight tell me votes on new gun laws here in Florida will happen by the end of this week. As Florida students keep up the pressure on lawmakers at today's tally rally, anger is turning into action.
Because it's created momentum to make sure something happens this time.
Today, Governor Rick Scott meeting with President Trump at the White House, who's setting into motion changes to gun laws at the federal level, including tougher background checks and arming teachers.
There's no way we'll leave town without getting this done. It's way too important.
And at the state level, Speaker Richard Corcoran telling ABC Action News today that the Republican-controlled legislature is poised to pass most of what Governor Rick Scott called for, including raising the minimum age to buy guns from 18 to 21, banning bump stocks, school resource officers in every school, and the so-called gun restraining order, allowing family members and law enforcement officials to get court orders to take away guns from people who are mentally ill or engage in violent behavior.
And that's, you know, that's the bottom line, Paul. We're going to do whatever it takes. Financially, laws, policy, we're going to do whatever it takes to make sure it never happens again.
But Speaker Corcoran is also pushing to arm teachers, something the governor disagrees with. But now it appears to be a bargaining chip to pass a sweeping reform to Florida's gun laws,
great,
the likes of which Florida has never seen before. Still tonight, Democrats say the changes don't go far enough.
We need a complete ban on assault rifles. Anything less does not go far enough to protect our children.
And tonight, lawmakers are up against the clock on this when fast-tracking the debate and the votes on this entire package of new gun laws. With just 2 weeks left to go in this legislative session, Speaker Corcoran tonight tells me it will get done.
Lovely. The Washington Post is reporting that officials in at least four countries have privately discussed ways they can manipulate Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, by taking advantage of his complex business arrangements, financial difficulties, and lack of foreign policy experience, according to current and former U.S. officials familiar with intelligence reports on the matter. Among those nations reportedly discussing ways to influence Kushner to their advantage were the United Arab Emirates, China, Israel, and Mexico. It's unclear if any of those countries acted on the discussions, but Kushner's contacts with certain foreign government officials have raised concerns inside the White House and are a reason he has been unable to obtain a permanent security clearance. Kushner's interim security clearance was downgraded from the top secret to the secret level, which should restrict the regular access he has had to highly classified information. This according to administration officials.
The threat essentially and the new action that White House Chief of Staff John Kelly said he would take indeed has been taking effect now. And that, of course, applies to a variety of officials here at the White House who have had temporary security access, top secret access. That is now being changed. First among them is Jared Kushner, of course, a senior advisor to the president, as well as the president's son-in-law. He has been operating under a temporary top secret security clearance since the first days of the administration. He has learned in recent weeks that his permanent clearance is not coming anytime soon because of questions about his background. He, of course, has been at the center of some of the inquiry that Robert Mueller has been leading. So this is going to be delaying that. But it's unclear exactly how this will impact his job. He is a senior advisor to the president who had a very wide portfolio, particularly dealing in Middle East peace, who needs top secret access to go through all of this if he's going to be effective here. So he, I am told by another person familiar with this, has not asked the president to intervene in this. He has not asked the president for a special dispensation, if you will, is going to be treated the same as any other White House official. Now, we saw the president on Friday here at the White House. He said that this would be left up to the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly. He said that Jared Kushner is doing a great job, but it's left up to John Kelly. So as it looks like right now, Jared Kushner is losing his top secret security clearance. It certainly changes his role here in the White House, even though people close to him, as well as his lawyer, has said he'll still be able to do his work, the same work, but it is entirely different, not having that top secret security clearance.
That's Jeff Zeleny from CNN. Meanwhile, NBC News is reporting that the U.S. intelligence community developed substantial evidence that state websites or voter registration systems in seven states were compromised by Russian-backed covert operatives prior to the 2016 elections, but they never told the states involved.
NBC News has learned that top secret intelligence requested by President Obama during his last weeks in office identified seven states where there was substantial evidence that state websites or voter registration systems were compromised by Russian-backed covert operatives prior to the 2016 election. All the state and federal officials we spoke to agree. No votes were changed and no voters were taken off the rolls. And six of the seven states deny their systems were breached based on their own cyber investigations. Overnight, a Department of Homeland Security spokesman disputing NBC's report in a tweet saying it is not accurate and undermines their efforts.
White House Communications Director Hope Hicks was on Capitol Hill on Tuesday to testify before the House Intelligence Committee, but she didn't answer many questions. Congressman Denny Heck of Washington said the committee, quote, got Bannoned.
White House Communications Director Hope Hicks refusing to answer key questions in the Russia probe, frustrating Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee.
I have less hope we'll get to all the answers.
Was there been a subpoena issued for her?
No.
Should there be?
Yes.
Why is that?
With anyone who doesn't answer questions, they ought to be subpoenaed, brought forth.
Republicans and Democrats on the panel had previously called on President Donald Trump's close advisor to answer all their questions about the transition and her time in the White House. But lawmakers from both parties said she wouldn't answer key questions about topics after the 2016 campaign. Hicks's unwillingness follows former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon, saying he was instructed by the White House to invoke executive privilege on behalf of President Trump over matters that occurred after the campaign. And former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski also wouldn't discuss topics after he left the campaign in June 2016.
For some reason, the White House press briefing today, scheduled for this afternoon, was canceled without explanation. By the way, Hicks did tell House investigators that her work for Trump occasionally required her to tell white lies. Let me repeat that again. Her job occasionally required her to tell white lies. The New York Times reporting that after extended consultation with her lawyers, she insisted that she had not lied about matters material to the investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election and possible links to Trump associates. Yeah, sure. Dick's Sporting Goods, one of the nation's largest sports retailers, announced Wednesday morning that it was immediately ending sales of all assault-style weapons in its stores and that it would no longer sell high-capacity magazines or sell guns to anyone under the age of 21, regardless of local laws. This comes on the day that students here returned to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Donald Trump may have filed his paperwork to run for re-election in 2020, on Inauguration Day, but his campaign got a bit of a boost yesterday when it announced that Trump has tapped Brad Parscale, the top digital strategist and digital media director for his 26th campaign, as his campaign manager. Okay. I hope he just continues focusing in on 2020, because we need to look to 2018. It is primary season now, so make sure you're registered. By the way, Dems picked up two more legislative seats yesterday.
In Stratford, Connecticut, Democrats picked up a statehouse seat that's been held by Republicans for more than 40 years.
Wow.
And in Laconia, New Hampshire, a city that Trump won by 13 points, Democrats won by 7 points, flipping a state house seat from Republican to Democrat. The fifth time that's happened in New Hampshire over the last year. This, as Cook Political Report, has moved the special election in Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district from lean Republican to toss-up. Mm-hmm. President Trump carried that seat in the Pittsburgh suburbs by 20 points. Yesterday, the Democrat in that race, Connor Lamb, reported raising $3.2 million in the first 7 weeks of 2018. The vote is less than 2 weeks away.
Yeah, less than 2 weeks away. And that's one of those, look, it's a special election. Connor Lamb, not exactly the most progressive guy out there, but he's certainly better than his Republican opponent. It's one of those where you got to go out and vote Democrats, because at this point, every seat counts. Speaking of teachers, there's been a big teacher strike in West Virginia that hasn't gotten a whole lot of media attention. But a teacher strike that ground public schools to a halt across West Virginia is set to end tomorrow, a week after it began. Governor James Justice and the teachers' union representatives yesterday said they've come to an agreement. They announced a deal that signaled a win for unions in a reddening state, even though some lawmakers and even the teachers themselves expressed doubts it would ultimately work. The governor, Mr. Justice, a Republican, said that he had promised the state's teachers and other school employees a 5% raise and that he would create a task force to address the problem of rising insurance costs for public employees, a key issue in the strike. That's something else that Will Bunch has been writing about, so hopefully we'll get into that a little bit with him as well. We'll take a quick time out. That's a bit of what's news for now. As it keeps updating, and we do our best to stay on top of it. We'll take a break and come back on the other side with Will Bunch of the Philadelphia Inquirer and Philadelphia Daily News and the Attitude blog, all that next on the Nicole Sandler Show, NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Why are no satirical plays being written about Trump and company? I'll tell you today on Hightower's Radio Lowdown. Breaking news. Trump and company are a murderous mob. Specifically, they've been serial killers of the English language. The word fact was their first victim, assassinated last year by one of Trump's mobsters who poisoned it with a toxic substance named alternative fact. Their latest hit was a celebrated word from the literary world, satire. It embodies the artful use of sarcasm and ridicule to expose the vanity and vice of public figures. But Trump himself killed satire by starving it of any meaning. How can anyone satirize a presidency that is, in reality, nothing but a fully staged satire of vanity and vice? Satire involves exaggerating the flaws, mannerisms, etc. of various characters to convey how corrupt and contemptible they are. But it's impossible to exaggerate the awfulness of an administration that gleefully flaunts its awfulness every day. Take Trump's proposed budget. Please, delivered just in time for Valentine's Day, it's a stab to the heart of poor people, intentionally increasing poverty and hunger across our country. It would slash programs providing essential food, housing, and even heating assistance for about 50 million Americans, mostly children, old folks, poverty wage workers, and disabled people. Then there's Medicare and Medicaid, which most working-class Americans count on. Candidate Trump promised us that, quote, there will be no cuts in funding for these programs, but his Valentine budget features, guess what, hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. Not only has his cynicism killed satire, but his cynical health care cuts could also kill you. This is Jim Hightower saying, presidential budgets aren't just numbers, they're statements of a president's moral principles. No work of satire could ridicule Trump's morality as effectively as his own budget.
Need an antidote to the progressive blues? Want some good news about how grassroots folks are rebelling against the corporate powers and winning? Well, here's an easy-to-swallow pill for you, the Hightower Lowdown. Hightower's monthly newsletter will give you the lowdown, even as it lifts you up. It's 4 pages a month, jam-packed with facts you can use, actions you can take, and Jim's own Texas humor, all for only $15 a year. To become a Lowdowner, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener-supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
All right, we are back. Nicole Sandler here at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. Will Bunch is a national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Philly.com. You find him at Attitude.com as well. He's the author of The Burn Identity and Tear Down This Myth, and I love reading his column online. Hello, Will Bunch.
Hey, Nicole. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so good. I'm so glad to be on your show again.
Well, it's always great to talk with you. I always appreciate your time and your insight. And, the thing that we're going to spend most of the time on today gives us a nice respite from what I've been dealing with for the last 2 weeks. It was 2 weeks ago today that we had the shooting at Parkland. Right. I live 10 minutes from there. So this has been in my own backyard.
I knew it was in your area. Yeah.
So
it's unbelievable. Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that there because I felt the same way writing the Walter Cronkite piece as you did reading it, I guess, which is, we just do need a respite between, you know, the nonstop Trump insanity and then, the horrific shooting, which of course overlaps sometimes with the Trump insanity, but just the whole thing. So it's good to step back and get some more perspective. After sports and pop music, my other obsession in life is 1960s history, and so with this being the 50th anniversary of 1968, which was kind of the peak year for events, many of them tragic, unfortunately, but I'm probably going to be doing four or five columns looking at the 50th anniversary of kind of the different things that shaped our world. But as a journalist, the Walter Cronkite story is less known than some of the others, but it's just very important. So I was glad I was able to do it.
Yes. Well, what you wrote, it was 50 years ago last month that Walter Cronkite delivered, I guess, what was sort of an editorial comment. It was the closest thing to that a newsman did back in those days, because news was as it was supposed to be, objective. It was presented with just the facts, a lot of information and facts, and very little, if any, opinion, until Walter Cronkite decided to go to Vietnam and see for himself if he was being lied to. Now, please, I am not the student of the 60s as you are, so if I say anything that's wrong, don't hesitate to jump in and correct me. But this...
No, I mean, the basic premise of what you said is right. I mean, one thing just to set the stage, because, for anybody who's, you know, say under 30 or whatever, and is only really grown up in the present media environment with CNN and MSNBC and Fox and the other cable news channels. I mean, it'd be hard for a young person to imagine a world where newspapers, printed papers were the main source of news, honestly, mm-hmm. for people. But in terms of TV, which had become the other big source of news for people by the 1960s, you're talking about one half hour every night on different networks.
That was it. And so there were three networks. That was it. I lived in New York at the time. I'm 58. So
I'm 59 and grew up in New York. So we were watching the same.
Right.
We were watching the Chuck Scarborough and Sue Simmons, right, and all those people. So that's really funny. But there was local news, and that was a little bit. That was on for an hour or sometimes in New York. 2 hours later on, probably not in the 60s, but mm-hmm. In terms of the national news, I mean, you just had this tight half hour window, and it was very, being a history geek, I've even watched like old newscasts on YouTube sometimes just for the heck of it, and you know, it's very different from today's news, very very straight down the middle or whatever. But that's what made, as far as this Cronkite story is going, if you can just give me 1 or 2 minutes to set it up. Walter Cronkite was, along with Chet Hunley and David Brinkley, they were kind of the most two most pop on NBC. They were the two most popular newscasts, and Walter Cronkite was at CBS. And Cronkite in particular just had enormous trust with the public. I mean, his nickname was the most trusted man in America, because, you know, he had just a reputation for, like you said, playing it down the middle, being honest, being a very straight reporter, very fact oriented. And as far as the Vietnam War, you know, the U.S. involvement in Vietnam started in the early 60s, really escalated around 1965, and became a big story on the news. And, you know, there was conventional beltway wisdom in the 1960s, just like today. And back then, the conventional beltway wisdom was that this was essential in the fight against communism, that we couldn't let another country fall to the communists, that we had to defend South Vietnam to the death. And that's why it was worth sending, you know, 500,000 American troops. And we were getting to the point where thousands of them were dying every year. You know, ultimately 58,000 people would die. And so, you know, the news, even though it was down the middle, it did have this kind of government slant. They were relying on the U.S. generals who kept telling them that victory was, you know, there was a light at the end of the tunnel, the victory was just around the corner. In January 1968, so 50 years and 1 month ago, you had the Tet Offensive, which was just stepped up military campaign by North Vietnam and their revolutionary allies, who were called the Viet Cong, where all kinds of things happened, like they overran the U.S. embassy in Saigon or penetrated it anyway. And there was this firefight and five Americans died. And TV viewers saw this footage of this supposed fortress, this U.S. embassy in Saigon, with, you know, Viet Cong inside, you know, killing Americans. And it was just quite a shock, you know. And Walter Cronkite basically said, what the heck is going on here? And, I mean, he'd started out as a war correspondent. He'd covered World War II. He'd covered the Battle of the Bulge in Europe. He said, I want to go. And I think he had been to Vietnam once before, where he mainly, you know, met with generals and got the inside story. But he goes, I want to go back. And, you know, this time I want to really see, I want to talk not just to the generals, but to the grunts, you know, and spend as much time there and do a whole show. But the radical idea, which he had, and also his boss, Dick Saland, who was the president of CBS News, surprisingly signed on to, was, you know, I have so much trust and credibility of the American people. They're really thirsting for answers on Vietnam, what we should do. What if I go over there, spend a week there, you know, we do this show, and at the end of the show, I tell America what I think, my conclusion based on what I've seen. And that was like such a radical idea, you know. I mean, it was revolutionary at the time. So he went there, and not surprisingly, you know, the generals still tried to spin him that things were going well. And then he went out towards the field, and he saw things were going not so well for the Americans. Mm-hmm. And he visited Hue, which was kind of the scene of the heaviest fighting at that time. And when he flew back from Hue, he was on a military helicopter with 12 dead U.S. Marines in body bags, or in a helicopter with him. And it was just, you know, this sobering experience. You know, and he met with CBS's younger reporters who, you know, told him, look, things, you know, things are really not going too well here. So he came back and he went on the air and he said, you know, well, are we winning or losing the war? Here's my opinion. We're mired in a stalemate.
Here, I've got, you know, a little bit of the audio that you actually have posted in the piece up at on your blog. Let me play that for you. It's just under a minute.
Oh, great.
This is Walter, Walter Cronkite from 50 years ago last night, telling the American people the truth about what was happening in Vietnam.
To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe, in the face of the evidence, the optimists who have been wrong in the past. To suggest we are on the edge of defeat is to yield to unreasonable pessimism. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion. On the off chance the military and political analysts are right, in the next few months we must test the enemy's intentions in case this is indeed his last big gasp before negotiations. But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. This is Walter Cronkite. Good night.
Wow. And you write, Will Bunch, that you said the message that was crafted by Cronkite and his main producer, Ernest Leiser, and delivered at the end of a 10 p.m. primetime CBS News special report may sound measured when viewed today in a world accustomed to the 24/7 shouting of cable news, but it caused a political earthquake. Think about that now, just a simple commentary like that delivered at the end of a 10 o'clock newscast, the effect of it would barely be a ripple. But back then, because we did just have those three channels, because Walter Cronkite was Walter Cronkite, the most trusted name in news, how did you put it? The most trusted man in America.
I was going to say, one reason why this story, it was a big deal at the time. And one reason why the story, had legs, as they say, and why people still talk about this 50 years later. Well, I mean, there's a couple of reasons why, but one of them is, it's widely believed that this had some impact on Lyndon Johnson, it wasn't something that changed him, 180 degrees from one direction or the other, but as he was learning that his presidency was kind of losing its grip, this was really kind of a tipping point kind of moment for him. There's this ongoing debate that's never going to be resolved among historians. At one point, LBJ's former press secretary said, that LBJ watched the show and said, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. Now, he may not have actually said that, but it's one of those quotes that survived, because even if he didn't actually say those words, mm-hmm. That was basically the gist of the import of what happened. That Cronkite was seen as kind of a surrogate for what the average, middle class, heartland, middle American. He was from Texas, Walter Cronkite. Just what the regular person thought. He was seen as a stand-in for that. And if somebody like Cronkite was saying that we couldn't win the war and that we should negotiate a peace, that's what we should do. And so a month after the show, LBJ did two things. One, he announced he was eligible to run for another term, and everybody expected him to do that in 1968. And he didn't. He dropped out of the presidential race. Can you imagine Trump or like Obama in 2012? Not running for another term.
Right.
I mean, you can imagine.
Well,
what,
I can imagine
kind of
Trump not
like.
Running. It's wishful thinking.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry. He's not. Yeah, that's not a good example, possibly. But
he already announced his campaign manager. It's just wishful thinking for me that he drops out. Yeah.
That's another story. But the other thing is, he also. Very shortly after that, went to the negotiations, did go to negotiations with North Vietnam and with the Viet Cong, which is a whole other story, which would take we need another extra hour of airtime to explain all the twists and turns that happened after that. But it did change the kind of bias towards, we're going to win this war militarily no matter what, to, we're willing to negotiate a deal on that. Unfortunately, that process took 5 years, and like I said, another story. Richard Nixon basically sabotaged it at one point, which was kind of the one of the first presidential acts of treason, which is now in vogue again. But the Cronkite thing, I've kind of known about it, coming up as a young journalist, I've been aware of the story. I think it really gained a lot of fresh importance for me. And actually, I remember writing a post about this maybe 9 or 10 years ago, after the war in Iraq, because I'd become very interested at that point in the whole issue of journalistic objectivity, reporting things on one hand or the other hand, the issue of journalists trying to find the kind of balance when there are certain issues, climate change is maybe the ultimate example where there aren't really two sides to the story, but journalists feel like compelled to find one. Mm-hmm. And the way that Walter Cronkite cut through all the baloney in this particular episode stood out to me as one of those moments. Maybe any listeners who saw the George Clooney movie Good Night and Good Luck about Edward R. Murrow and Joseph McCarthy was another moment that was kind of like that in the history of American journalism, but. I mean, these moments are kind of famous because they were so rare, I probably would have memorialized the 50th anniversary of this no matter what, because even if you know Hillary Clinton had won in last year, 2016, you know, I probably would have written this story because it's just a great yarn, and it's important for journalists to know. And it's one of the things I like writing about is media and journalism reform. But, you know, with Trump's victory, I just feel like this story is, you know, quadrupled in importance. Wow. Because, you know, people talked about the credibility gap in Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers and how it showed the government was lying to America about Vietnam. But now we have a president who is documented telling 40 or 50 lies every week, you know, about things that are, you
right.
know, as trivial as his, you know, the size of his inauguration crowd, and things that are as important as whether Russia is, you know, interfering in U.S. politics. You know, he just lies about everything. And, you know, how are journalists supposed to react to that?
He's also the guy, as you write in here, Team Trump has declared that a functioning free press is the, quote, enemy of the American people. And threatened other right. norms. I mean, and that's the gist. I mean, that's what really hits me about this story. You ask in the piece, you write, in 2018, can journalists look past the blinders of contrived objectivity, stare straight into the camera, and speak the plain truth? And when they do, will America listen the way it listened to Walter Cronkite in 1968? I don't know if you heard it, but Carter Page was on Sean Hannity's show. I'm just going to play you a quick 14-second clip because I think you'll get a kick out of it. This is Carter Page talking to Sean Hannity.
What do you make of the coverage in this country that has been for the last year, then?
Sean, you know, in that context, I have to thank you because you have been the Edward R. Moreau of this whole process. You know,
the media's going to love that comment.
Not only does he mispronounce Edward R. Murrow's name, but it's blasphemy. I mean, you know,
I mean, talking about a good night and good luck.
Right.
But, yeah.
So how do you answer that question? Right. Will America ever listen to a newscaster the way it listened to Walter Cronkite? Or is that's just an era that's past us?
Right. Well, you can't, in a way it is, unfortunately. I mean, you can't put that genie in the bottle. You can't go back to three networks doing a 30-minute newscast every night. And, you know, and if we tried to do that, I think all of us would be frothing at the mouth. It's like, we want more coverage. You know, it would seem so bizarre and so limiting. It's just like, you know, like only having five channels on your TV and
right.
not having a remote and having to get up and
turn the
adjust
channel.
The antenna, you know, and all the crazy things that we used to do. I mean, you can't
no
easily
DVR,
go back. And,
right?
and that's the thing. I mean, you know, I mean, this is partly a story about journalists and what their responsibility is in regards to truth and being objective and when it's time to, you know, cut through some of the line. I mean, there's that part of the story. But the other part of the story, which is, you know, unfortunate, is, you know, we've spent these 50 years creating a world of alternate realities, you know, and there are millions of Americans who live in that reality that's been created by Sean Hannity and the people he has on his show. You know, I mean, I have to deal with the emails every day from the readers who, you know, whose view is just so warped, you know, that, you know, I mean, one of the biggest responses I got to that column from that element of reader, because I get a lot of emails from conservatives, was, you know, just, you know, how come you didn't mention the 8 years of constant lying by Barack Obama?
Oh, God.
You know? And look, you know, I was not an Obama worshiper, and there were a couple times I did call him out for things mm-hmm. that weren't fully honest or whatever, but when you just compare the overall track record of honesty of his administration to either the one that came before him or the one that came after him, there's just no comparison, you know.
Right.
But there are I don't know, 30, 50 million people, who even knows how many people, who live inside this bubble where that's their world. Well, you know, where Obama was the most dishonest president in American history and Hillary Clinton committed all kinds of crimes. And you know, I was not a big, you know, during the primary season, I was not a big Hillary person, but to call her a criminal is just absurd, you know.
Right.
I mean,
I'm right there with
so,
you.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, so Will Bunch is with us, and we're talking about a piece that he's got up. I will link to it from my blog at NicoleSandler.com. It's at Philly.com. It's about the 50th anniversary of Walter Cronkite doing something that, I mean, today doesn't seem so unusual, but back then it was. He told America the bitter truth, as it says in the headline. You know, today I'll find a clip online somewhere of Shepard Smith at Fox, you know, saying something that's truthful. And it's so unusual to me. It's like, oh, my God, there is somebody at Fox so-called news who is actually speaking the truth. Occasionally you'll even get Chris Wallace calling out the president for a lie or something like that. And it's so unusual. But one thing that your piece points out is the government had been lying to Walter Cronkite. They'd been lying about the progress that we were making in Vietnam. It wasn't until Cronkite got over there and saw for himself, he realized how blatantly he'd been lied to. That, I guess, that hasn't changed. What's changed is, I guess, our trust of the Fourth Estate and the maybe even the role of it in this era of Trump.
Right. I mean, after the Vietnam show, you know, I'm not going to pretend. I mean, you know, if you lived through the late 1960s or early 70s, I mean, it was an incredibly contentious time in ways that are sometimes similar and sometimes different to the contentious times that we live in now. But you know, I mean, there were people who, you know, thought Cronkite was too liberal or didn't like his opinion on Vietnam, and people who turned away from him. But I mean, the reaction was nothing like it was today. And the truth is, his credibility and his approval rating from the public, from viewers, only went up. I mean, in fact, during the 70s, he really solidified his position as the most popular newscaster, and his, you know, position in the polls as the most trusted person in America only increased after that Vietnam moment, which I don't think would happen today. I think there would just be too much negativity and too much tearing him down. And it was important not just because that he spoke the truth on Vietnam. I mean, that was critical, but it also set the stage for kind of a golden era that didn't last forever, unfortunately, but where I thought journalism really was a high point in terms of truth telling and investigative reporting. So you had the coverage of the Watergate scandal, for example, and Walter Cronkite himself was really a leader on that. In the fall of 1972, there were basically only three journalists in America who were taking the Watergate scandal seriously, you know, Woodward and Bernstein at the Washington Post and Walter Cronkite, who did two special reports on Watergate before the 72 election, because he thought voters needed to know about everything that was known at that time about Watergate before they went to the polls, which was quite a public service. Obviously, it didn't make a dent in Richard Nixon's landslide, and it wasn't until other things came out the next year that the Watergate scandal really took off. But it kind of shows that, you know, once Cronkite had been burned by LBJ and his other sources on Vietnam, he took a much more skeptical approach to the government, and it was reflected in their coverage of Watergate. And, you know, I think the same spirit was, you know, for all the people out there who saw the movie The Post recently, mm-hmm. you know, the Pentagon Papers, you know, again, was another case where editors realized the government's credibility on the line, and they realized how important it was to get this information out, and they were willing to take risks, you know, you know, I can't stress strongly enough. I mean, I feel that's the situation we find ourselves in today. You know, obviously the specifics are different and some of the aspects of it are different, but the need to somehow get out there to the public that the government isn't leveling with you is more powerful than ever. And, you know, it takes brave individuals, it takes smart tactics to do that, but I think that's the challenge journalists are facing in 2018.
And it's a huge challenge because, again, maybe it's because the media is so fragmented and because we do have you know, the Fox faction, as it were, and now Sinclair Broadcasting, which is even more perverse than Fox, if that is imaginable. You know, telling people that, you know, going along with the gaslighting of the administration, I talk about it as them telling us the sky is green and, you know, we're crazy.
Look at this. I mean, look at this recent episode with this Rob Porter, the wife beater who was working in the White House, right? You know, and you had the highest level people in the White House, you know, John Kelly, the chief of staff. You know, Hope Hicks, everybody else in the press operation was involved in just putting out a totally false story about, you know, about what they knew about Rob Porter and when they knew it. And, you know, both in their initial statements and then over the next couple of days at the briefings, they were putting out just easily disprovable versions of what had happened. And what's amazing is there was no consequences for that. You know, I mean,
still none.
John Kelly didn't lose his job.
But, nope.
He should have. I mean, I called for that in my column, you know, 2 days after. But he's still here. He's still, you know, feuding with Jared Kushner. You know, I mean, you know, it's remarkable. And that's part of the frustration of the Trump era. I mean, there's no question, and we all know that there is accountability journalism being done out there, and there's some really good, you know, there's some really good accountability journalism where people are, you know, fact checking and exposing just how blatantly dishonest some of these things are. The problem is, you know, journalists can't enforce consequences. That has to be done in other ways, and at least with the Trump White House, that doesn't seem to happen very often.
No, and it's the cutting through all the bullshit to get to what's real, and then earning people's trust. When you have the White House backing up so-called, I can't even call them news outlets, propaganda outlets like Breitbart or Gateway Pundit or some of these other, you know, Gateway Pundit, they have a pass to go into the White House briefing room. I mean, it just...
It's unbelievable.
It's frightening, yeah, is what it is. And it opens the door to this authoritarian era that it looks like Trump is pushing.
It does. I mean, the alternative to that is we also know that millions of people out there, and I would say it's a pretty safe bet, it's the majority of people out there are thirsting for the truth, you know? And so, I mean, when you look at the ratings, I mean, all those, you know, all those people like Breitbart and Gateway Pundit are trying to be propped up, but the most popular news show on TV right now is Rachel Maddow, you know? You know, she's got the highest rated show, which wasn't the case 2 or 3 years ago, but it's the case now because you have people clamoring for somebody to cut through all of this. And, and she is certainly doing that as much as she can. And, you know, and Chris Hayes and some of the other people, really do an excellent job. And there, like I said, there is accountability journalism being done. You know, David Fahrenthold at the Washington Post. I mean, on a not totally unrelated issue, I mean, journalism has played a huge part in helping to feed the whole Me Too movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the New York Times that exposed Harvey Weinstein.
That's right.
You know, Ronan Farrow. I mean, who had Ronan Farrow in the pool for somebody who was going to do Pulitzer Prize-worthy journalism in 2017?
not
but that's
me.
What happened.
Right,
you know?
Right. No, you're right. And again, and sometimes things do cut through. The Me Too movement is a prime example. The kids from Parkland cutting through with Never Again. Sometimes things, and we'll see what form it takes, and whether the good guys win or evil prevails. And I don't know the answer to that. You did say in this piece, rising authoritarianism is a time to toss one on one hand, on the other hand, out the window. But you mentioned that's what we get all too often. Some of these more objective sites, whether it be the New York Times or the Washington Post or one of the traditional broadcast news channels, you know, and especially with climate change, try to make it as something that there's two sides to cover, when really, no, there isn't. There's one side to this story, and the planet is heating up, and we're having all kinds of major calamities because of it, and it's only going to get worse. But when you have,
you know, I was just going to say, journalism is still struggling even now. Even we've been talking about this for a decade now, and they're still struggling to cope with this to the point where the New York Times, and you know, I want to preface this by saying the New York Times has done some amazingly good journalism in the last couple of years.
Yes, they have.
You know, a lot of what we know about, you know, Trump, Russia, and some of these other things, you know, we know because of good reporting by the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't forget that. But at the same time, you know, I mean, what are they thinking when they go out there and they do a whole multi-million-dollar ad campaign promising that what they give people is the truth? And then they go ahead and hire a climate change denier like Bret Stephens to be
right.
a columnist.
Exactly.
I mean, that was just that was just a mind-boggling decision by them, you know, because it just shows they don't understand. It's like they don't understand their own brand, and they don't understand what it is, you know, the reason they don't understand the reason their subscriptions spiked dramatically after Trump was elected in November 2016, and what those people are looking for. You know, hiring Bret Stephens and some of these other lesser moves that they made have just been a slap in the face to their audience. You
yeah,
know?
I read something today about a semi-revolt at the New York Times over what's happening at the editorial page.
Right. So it's just such a complex. It's just such a complex environment right now, you know, for the media, and you know, it's another case of, you know, that Trump and Trumpism has scrambled everything, you know.
Yes.
You know, when Trump is out there calling the media the enemy of the American people, I mean, you would hope that would get a powerful unified response, but it doesn't always play out that way.
No. And you have people going, yeah, the media lies. They're the evil ones. And they cheer Trump on at his rallies as he points to the, you know, the press riser in the back of the room and lies about the people that are standing there to the point where some of them have to fear for their lives. It's sort of opposite
Nicole,
world.
Nicole, it's funny, you know, when you go to these rallies, I went to a big rally Trump had in December of 2016. So a month after he'd been elected. You know, he did this, like, he was bored, so he did this feel good rally tour where he went to some of the battleground states,
right,
just to have rallies. Campaign started for the heck of it. And, you know, so here he is, he'd won already. And I was curious, like, what's he going to talk about, or what are the people here for? And, you know, and I got to the arena maybe an hour and a half early so I could talk to people. And what I basically got from people was spewing of hate towards the media. I mean, that wasn't just like a side issue to them. That was the issue. You know, the people who made homemade signs and brought them to this rally, they were all signs against CNN.
Wow.
CNN sucks,
yep,
or whatever, different things about CNN. People chanting CNN sucks during breaks in the rally. I mean, this wasn't, you know, like I said, this wasn't just like some interesting thing about the movement. This is the movement. That's, I mean, hatred of the media, you know, I mean, it's hatred of elites to some degree, but the media is the most visible elite to them and the most easiest to hate, basically. And, you know, this is a bond that's holding together 35% of the American people. Kind of scary, right?
It's frightening.
And to
bring it full circle, you go back to the days of Walter Cronkite and the most trusted man in America. He's got to be rolling over in his grave as to what's happened to his media. But then again, you have people doing programs that have the word news in the title, blatantly lying about things. You know, when he worked so hard to uncover the lies, right, to point them out and to disavow us of them. Now we have people in using the term news, which should be illegal. And I guess it is technically on over-the-air media, television and radio, to call an opinion show a news program. But there's no oversight of that at the FCC. And with cable so diluting everything, they can do anything they want on cable. There is no oversight.
Right. There's no regulation. And of course, there's even less on the Internet. And
that's right.
You know, half the video content that people watch is things in their Facebook feed or whatever. So and they can be from these totally fake newscasts. They can be from, you know, RT, Russian television, or Sputnik, you know.
Remember fake news. Fake news was what they did on Saturday Night Live. You know, it was comedy. That was Stephen, you know, the Colbert Report. It was
right.
Daily Show. That was fake news. Now it's a real thing, except it's not what we're being told. It's the gaslighting of America. And actually, I heard Dana Loesch even use the term the other day, which I found so offensive, because while they're gaslighting us, she took it and tried to turn it around on us again, saying we're the ones doing the gaslighting, which I guess is the ultimate in gaslighting, trying to tell us that the sky is green when it's blue.
Yeah, I mean, that's no surprise, right? Because that's exactly what they did with fake news also. I mean, fake news started out as a term that was trying to get a handle on mostly, not exclusively, but mostly right-wing sites or sites,
Fox.
You know, people trying to make a profit
right.
out of Macedonia. And it was a real thing. And then once people were onto it, all of a sudden you had Trump and Trump supporters adopting the term fake news, but using it to describe CNN or the New York Times or the Washington Post, which is pretty horrible. And not only that, it's been reported, some of the world's other dictators, as I like to call them, you know, like Erdogan in Turkey or Duterte in the Philippines or whatever. Now they start talking about fake news.
Yep.
I mean, this has become the rallying cry of the world's authoritarians and despots. And, so I guess they've got a lot of mileage out of that. So now they're going to do the same thing with gaslighting, apparently. Right?
It's frightening. It is opposite world. It's a term I've used for years. And they tell you.
Bizarro world.
It is.
Bizarro world. I think they called it on Superman, right?
Yeah. You know, and all that said, the news media is far from perfect. In fact, again, I've been living in a world of mass shootings for the last 2 weeks.
Right.
Not to say that it didn't deserve the coverage, but you actually wrote another column on the teacher strike in West Virginia. And I got to say, I really haven't seen much about that anywhere. So thank you for writing about it. Is this thing really over?
Yeah.
Do we know in the minute or two we have left?
It's very frustrating because I just feel like, you know, I think it's a broader problem, too, because I think if you go back in time, if you remember 2015, when Bernie Sanders campaign was really catching fire, and you know, I realize even mentioning Bernie's name is, you know, gets half the people in the audience riled up and whatever. But just stepping back from that, back in the final years of Obama's presidency, before we knew really what was coming, there was a lot of talk about income inequality, about raising the minimum wage, about how do we strengthen labor unions. About, you know, basic economic fairness in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, those were the things we were talking about. And, Trump and Trumpism has kind of taken the oxygen out of that conversation. And I was so thrilled to see the teachers in West Virginia bringing that conversation back, you know, the fact that it's just ridiculous how little these teachers get paid, or making $10,000, $15,000 a year less than people just over the border in other states. And they finally said, we're not going to take it. And, you know, they had the cohesion and the strength to, you know, basically shut down every public school in the state of West Virginia.
Yeah.
And they did it with a lot of class. You know, they made lunches for kids who were in the free and reduced lunch program, which unfortunately there's a lot of those kids in West Virginia. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really an amazing thing. And they essentially won. You know, they went from getting a 1% raise to a 5% raise, which of course still
not
enough, doesn't come close to paying them what they're worth. But in the context of what they were trying to do, they got government and the public on their side, and they got government to listen to them. And they reminded us again that unions can do important things if we empower our unions and. It was a real thing. And it was like the 20 seconds at the end of the hour after we've talked about the dumb thing Trump said today for 55 minutes.
Right.
And then in 15 seconds, it's like, oh, by the way, teachers are going back to work in West Virginia. Like, and that was it, you know, and it just was very frustrating.
Rather than cover the fact that they'd been on strike for almost a week, this went on.
Yeah.
tomorrow. I guess they go back to work tomorrow, which would be a week.
It's been a week,
And they were out across the state, and you know, barely heard a blip about it.
That was a real failure, and just kind of shows what's happened in the last couple of years. I don't know what to say, because I mean, in my column, I write about Trump way too much, I guess, maybe,
But he's right there.
Because you can't avoid him.
Because
you know, what's a bigger danger than rising authoritarianism
nothing.
In this country, right?
Absolutely nothing.
So, It's hard not to write about that and not write about it a lot. But then look at all the important conversations we're not having because of that.
It's a no-win situation. Because he sucks all the air out of the room. Because there's always something.
Exactly.
It's in every 5 minutes. I mean, there are stories in his administration that don't get covered because he does something else. that should be front page news that barely get mentioned because he's done something else even worse. And unthinkable. It's just the times we're living in.
Just the day-to-day corruption of all his cabinet members. I mean, those things would have been, if they'd happened at another time, would have been the newscast stories.
Yes. Look, Ben Carson and his $31,000 dining room table for his office. And I haven't even spoken about that yet. And here we are at the end of the hour, out of time. Will Bunch from the Philadelphia Daily News, the Philadelphia Inquirer. The easiest way to get to him is at attitude.com. I'll put a link on my blog to the story about Walter Cronkite and the one about the West Virginia teacher strike as well, so people can read those. Will Bunch, thank you so much. It's always great to talk with you. I always appreciate your time.
It is always great, Nicole. I really appreciate you having me on. So thank you.
My pleasure. We'll talk again soon. Take care.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.